Hi, I'm an addict named David.
Hi, David.
Grateful to be here and grateful for all of you for showing up. Paul was mentioning Greg, and I have enormous respect and affection for Greg. He was only my sponsor for a year and a half, but I had known him for about 13 years. And one of the first things I noticed about him was that he was wearing like a whole necklace of amethysts. And we talked about that briefly, and I always carry a pocket full of rocks. You know, I've always got stones on my fingers and bells on my toes, and I also noticed that he was an astrologer, which I am too. And we had other things in common, and we connected very quickly. I have a sponsee today who's an astrologer, and it's connection. The thing about Greg is that he was consistent. You know, what I saw over time was that he had an open heart and he had the willingness to listen to anybody. And one of the important things that I've learned from many addicts, Greg included, was the importance of a balanced life. I think that that's the nub of my problem as an addict, is my tendency to be an extremist. In fact, we love being extremists. We revel in being extremists. We enjoy seeing just how far we can go. You know, we push people to the very edge to see if they'll push back. I don't know if you've noticed. But it's important for me to seek balance in my life in all regards, both in what I eat and what I do and how I behave and how I, even how I appear. You know, I believe in being moderate, and that moderation is one of the virtues for me to seek. Example, you know, there's a lot of addict dodges. One of the addict dodges I see among the very young these days is paint your hair orange, wear studs and rings in your eyebrows and tongue, and wear black lipstick and outlandish clothing, and then the first time somebody stares at them, glare at them for staring at you. Like, how dare they? It's an addict dodge. And, you know, we've got 1,000 of them. There's a lot of different ways in which we can lead a life out of balance. But I believe, for instance, just for me, now this isn't necessary for anybody else. Just for me, it's important for me to be physically invisible. And by this, I don't mean that you would miss me. I mean, I'm 215 pounds, so you're not going to miss me. But what I mean is that I don't want to be focused on for outside appearances. I prefer to be moderate in my dress and my appearance and my hair and so forth. My hair turned white by the time I was 45. And I didn't want to be treated like a grandpa, so I colored my hair. You know, there's some people who would judge me for that, but I don't need to bring on the judgments of other people. I can do very well just by putting my foot in my mouth. Thank you. One of the hard things for me to do over time, but has been precious in recovery, is learning from people I don't agree with. That's much more important for me than learning from people I do agree with. I mean, that's easy. You know, loving the people you love is easy. Loving the people you can't stand, that's hard. I was taught maybe 10 years ago to try to simplify my program, to try to find ways to see it in a simple way. One of the ways I heard was to look at this as an eightfold program, that there's eight aspects to the program of recovery: meetings, steps, sponsorship, fellowship, reading and writing, prayer and meditation, service, and telephone. You know, the 1,000-pound telephone? And that this is the eightfold program of recovery, at least the way we do it in NA. And if I avail myself of all of those eight things, I have a beautiful, rounded, rich program. If all I do is come to meetings, I've only availed myself of 1/8 of what this program has to offer. And, that's a pretty small fraction. It's all here for us if we want it, and if we're willing to work for it, if we're willing to go to any lengths for it. And in thinking about that this summer, I realized you could boil it down even further, that there's a 3-part program. That it's connection, participation, and action. And by this I mean we have to connect with a conscious contact with a higher power. I have to stay in contact. I have to make the connection, not just on a daily basis, but on a more continual basis, so that I'm aware of God's presence all the time. Participation is a major part of it, is going to meetings and being part of, participating in my own recovery. Nobody's going to come and wave a magic wand over me and say, "You're recovered." It doesn't work that way. We do not have fairy godmothers of recovery. What we have is a program, and action. That's working steps with a sponsor. At least a major part of my action today is working steps with a sponsor. I also believe that there are simple tools versus power tools. In carpentry, simple tools is like a screwdriver and a hammer. And those are fine, they're useful for a lot of things, but you need power tools if you're going to build a house. You need drills and power saws and all that good stuff. Same thing in recovery. My simple tools are keep coming back and call your sponsor, and it works if you work it. My power tools are the steps and the traditions. And when I make use of those power tools, I have a powerful program. When I don't make use of them, I have an iffy program. So it's up to me to plug in my program all the time. The topic for this convention is interesting, nothing to fear. And my first reaction was, well, I don't know about that. There's an awful lot of things in this world to fear. I was talking about that this morning, that if you're in the jungle, it's normal to fear tigers. If you're in an apartment in New York City, it's abnormal to be afraid of tigers or to be worrying about them. But fear is a normal condition of an immature state. See, early in recovery, I was afraid of all kinds of stuff. I was afraid people wouldn't like me. I was afraid I would jinx my recovery if I did anything wrong. Maybe that was a good thing. It was probably a good thing that I did everything by the book because I was afraid I was going to jinx my recovery. I'm not so scared of that today, but I'm glad I had the good background. See, when I'm secure and God-centered, and when I'm surrounded by love and at peace with my love with life and with myself, and if I'm filled with light, then there's nothing to fear. It seems as though when I'm spiritually centered and when I'm grasping the essence of recovery, then there's nothing to fear. And even things that are scary normally, I will get through quickly, and I'll process quickly, and I won't have to linger in worry and doubt and fear. I got to meet a number of you when I spoke in Kalamazoo 4 years ago, and you may remember a phrase I used then, which is, it's only a situation, not an emergency. Middle of the night, the guy who was doing the tapings ran off with the money and the tapes, and in the morning, when the committee was explaining it all, they said, well, like David said, it's only a situation, not an emergency. And it's funny how little phrases sometimes can make a difference in how I process information. The idea is, however, not to have to use little phrases, but to be able to process them by having a mature outlook and a spiritual viewpoint. I do believe that there's a difference between rational fear and irrational fear. Rational fear is like the fear of the edge of the cliff. When I'm in traffic and tired and I feel myself falling asleep and I get scared, what am I doing? I want that fear to make me pull over. If I were fearless in a situation like that, I might be dead. But irrational fear is like the fear that people who love me will suddenly stop loving me, or that people who care about me will make fun of me, or that I'm too old or too young or too fat or too thin or too whatever to have a happy life. To me, these are irrational fears, born mostly of misinformation. I believe that we have a fear-based instinct. They call it the flight or fight instinct. That's where the adrenals kick up and you get all excited. And there's a purpose for that. There's a real important evolutionary purpose for that. But the purpose of that instinct is to help us survive, not to live in a constant state of stress. See, and that's kind of what I did to myself for quite a few years. I would not clean up my messes until they got out of hand, and then I had to live in a state of stress until it was cleaned up, and I had people mad at me all the time. And it should come as no surprise that I lived in fear and worry and doubt. There's an analogy given in some spiritual schools. They call it the calm eye in the center of the cyclone. And you know how an eye forms in the middle of a hurricane. Well, it's a similar idea that life swirls around me, but I don't have to be swept up in it. If I'm conscious, if I'm God-centered, if the I that is I sees and is unblinking and doesn't put itself to sleep, if I'm wide awake to the spirit, then I can be calm and I don't have to be swept up in the fury of everyday life. Sometimes I hear people say that faith is the opposite of fear. And I don't know that that's true, or I hear people say that faith and fear can't exist in the same mind at the same time. Hey, I don't believe that. It's happened to me all my life that I've been able to edge faith out with fear, or edge fear out with faith. See, it's not like an all at once or all or nothing proposition, but we addicts, we like to think in black and white, don't we? We go to extremes. We're extremists by nature. I think that faith is the opposite of despair. Faith means that no matter how tough things go, you know that God will support you and God will help. I think security is the opposite of fear, because most of the problems of my life occurred because I was insecure. As a little kid, I was very sensitive. I was picked on by the bullies and I was laughed at by the class. And I worried all the time about approval and about being loved, you know. My father bullied me, my sister bullied me, and with that mindset, I ended up with the bullies bullying me, too. And, you know, that creates a lot of worry and anxiety and neurosis for a little kid. I don't need to tell you that drugs help that quite a bit. You know, using worked for a while for me. When I first got high, it was like I'd found my best friend. For a while, I was very comfortable using, and it seemed to be the answer to my life. I was relaxed with people, I wasn't worried all the time, I was enjoying myself, but that only worked for a little while. It's like I had many acid trips, and the last three times I took acid, I said to myself, well, this is why I don't take acid anymore. But see, it took three times. Because being a good addict, we just keep pushing that button and pushing that button, expecting, you know, the pack of candy to come out of the machine. And it just won't. It just won't. Courage isn't the absence of fear. It's what gets us through fear. No thanks. Courage is the spiritual principle that helps me walk through my fear. You know, it's like tells me that I'm supported. It's sort of like a bridge over a chasm. The thing about courage and faith is that they're invisible bridges. You know, I don't know for sure that I'll meet God on the other side, but I have a good sense that I will. So I'm willing to count on those invisible bridges and know that I won't slip up or that I won't slide into the chasm. But I have to be practicing those principles. It doesn't seem to work if I'm only faking it. You know, when people say fake it till you make it, I think this is a misinterpretation of spiritual principle, because the real saying was act as if you had faith and faith will be given to you. Well, you can plug any spiritual principle into this if you want. Act as if you had patience, and patience will be given to you. Act as if you had courage, and courage will be given to you. Act as if you had love, and you'd be surprised what'll happen. But, you know, a lot of our fears arise in ignorance, and ignorance begets fear, and that begets anger, and that begets hate. I think the problem is that sometimes we put down education. You know, I'm an over-educated addict. I mean, I've been reading and studying my whole life, and early in recovery, there were members in my home group or in my area who made fun of me for being an over-educated addict. But you know what? It isn't our differences that's important. It's speaking heart to heart. It's relating one to another, and it's being willing to see the light in each other's eyes. I'm very glad that people encouraged me. You know, one of the things that almost scared me off this program was that I was not one of those ripe candidates for tough love. There were people who bullied me early in my recovery, and I'd had enough bullying in my life, you know? And I think it's a case-by-case situation. I think that there's some people who need to be pushed and some people who need to be embraced. And it might be different for different people at different times. There might be days that I need to be pushed and different days that I need to be embraced. See? So it isn't all just one thing. Many shades of gray and many colors. Just a little more on fear. There's a song, if you folks are familiar with the musical, The King and I by Rodgers and Hammerstein, which goes, "I whistle a happy tune." And where Miss Anna, the teacher, sings, "While trembling in my boots, I hold myself erect and whistle a happy tune, and no one will suspect I'm afraid." And she says, "As the result of this deception is very plain to see, whenever I fool the people I fear, I fool myself as well," or very plain to tell. And, you know, it's not about fooling anybody. It's about what I'm focused on. We can break ourselves out of a rigid or a negative state if we have the willingness to do so. The thing about fear is that it builds on itself, and faith builds on itself too. It's called emotional reinforcement. Example, if I breathe deeply, I'm relaxed. And if I'm relaxed, I breathe deeply. If I breathe shallowly, I get uptight. And when I'm uptight, I breathe shallowly. It's like a loop. One causes the other, and one reinforces the other. So I tell my sponsees, remember to keep breathing deeply. And, you know, some of them laugh and say, "Oh, you told me to keep breathing deeply," like it was a joke. But guess what? If you study martial arts, if you study meditation, the very first thing they teach you is control of the breath. They won't take you into the advanced techniques until you've learned to master the breath. That's how important it is. It's crucial for us to remember to keep breathing deeply. And one of the ways I do that on a daily basis is through laughter. Early in recovery, I had the blessing of coming into a very small amount of money from my uncle's estate. And I got a color TV and cable. And I was watching, on an almost daily basis, stand-up comedy. And I realized very quickly how important this was, that daily laughter seemed to be like a tonic to me, as just as important as my meetings. And to this day, I suggest to my sponsees that they watch stand-up comedy on a regular basis. I also tell jokes. In fact, my father had 4 jokes he could tell well. I have about 300 or 400, I haven't counted. I've been collecting a joke book over the last 5 years, and I hope to publish it sometime soon. But what I found is that humor gets us breathing deeply. It breaks up our crystallization. It allows us to see things in a new way, and it dispels fear. Few things break up fear better than laughter. For example, how many addicts does it take to change a light bulb? 2. One to come up with the $10 and the other to promise to be right back with the light bulb. Okay. Some of you heard that. You know what many addicts are using these days for birth control? Their personalities. So these two addicts are playing golf, and one addict says, guess what, my wife is expecting triplets. And his friend says, really, congratulations, that's terrific. And the first guy says, yeah, it only happens once every 240,000 times. His friend says, no kidding, I'm surprised you have time to play golf. You don't mind an Irishman's joke, because this Irishman's in the hospital, in a hospital bed, and his friend Finnegan visits O'Malley, and O'Malley says, ah, Finnegan, 'tis the cirrhosis I'm dying of now. Sorry to say. But would you do me a favor, after I've passed away, would you honor me by pouring a quart of fine Irish whiskey on me grave? And Finnegan says, O'Malley, 'tis proud I would be to do that, but would you mind very much if I passed it through me kidneys first? No addict's going to waste his dope, right? And have you heard the news? A midget psychic has escaped from jail. They're calling him a small medium at large. Okay, this one I got on the internet. It's on addict love and relationships. What do addicts take along on the second date? A U-Haul. Another one I got on the internet is a man in a hot air balloon realizes, you heard this. A man in a hot air balloon realizes that he is lost, and he reduces height, and he spots a man below. Well, he gets closer, and he yells out, excuse me, can you help me? I promised a friend that I'd meet him a half hour ago, but I don't know where I am. Well, the man below says, yes, you are in a hot air balloon, hovering about 30 feet above the ground. You are at latitude 42 degrees north and longitude 80 degrees west. Well, you must be a sponsor, says the balloonist. I am, replies the man. How did you know? Well, says the lost man, everything you told me is technically correct, but I have no idea what to make of your information, and the fact is, I'm still lost. The man on the ground says, you must be a sponsee. His reply was, why, yes, how did you know? Well, replies the man on the ground, you don't know where you are or where you are going. You have made a promise which you have no idea how to keep, and you expect me to solve your problem. The fact is that you were in the same position you were in before we met, but now it is somehow my fault. I just got two more. It's about the rabbi and the minister in the bank at the banquet. And everybody's eating ham steaks, and the rabbi's eating the usual rubber chicken because he can't have the ham. And so the rabbi and priest. And the priest starts teasing the rabbi. He says, so rabbi, have you ever tried ham? And the rabbi turns a little red. He says, well, I'll tell you the truth. Once when I was a young man at the seminary, I was feeling a little adventurous one night, and I went out and had a ham sandwich. So tell me something, father, have you ever had sex with a woman? The priest turns beet red, and he says, well, Rabbi, to tell you the truth, once when I was a young man in the seminary, before I took my vows, I was feeling a little adventurous, and I went out, and I met a woman, and I had sex with her. The rabbi says, beats the hell out of a ham sandwich, doesn't it? So, this guy goes to heaven, and he gets a tour of all the optional rooms that he can go to. And he's being shown down the hallway, and this one room he's passing has a bunch of people on their knees, crossing themselves, and he says, what's that? His guide says, those are the Catholics. And they're kneeling and crossing themselves very seriously, very intently. Then he passes another room, and there's a bunch of people sitting cross-legged, saying, Aum. And he says, those are the Hindus. And then he passes another room, and there's a bunch of people rocking back and forth and davening. Those are the Orthodox Jews. And he passes another room, he smells coffee, and he hears laughter and applause, and he says, who are they? And his guide says, well, they won't tell us. They say it's an anonymous program, but they give us a big hug and tell us to keep coming back. So, you know, I think we have a place in whatever God has in mind for us. There's a lot that's good about being an addict for me today. You know, I come from a life where, I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I'm not really into telling stories, because I figure we've all got stories and they're a dime a dozen, and my favorite story was about the flat tire that kept me from coming to work 8 weeks in a row. You know, same damn flat tire too, amazing how that happens. But if I could get some water, that'd be great. Thanks a lot. Thanks so much. Thanks a lot. I was born in Montreal, Canada in 1950, moved to Florida in 1962 with my family. I was a lonely kid. I felt very misunderstood. I did not use until I was 19 years old, and I can even give you the date. It was January the 12th, 1970, that I picked up my first drug, smoked some pot. And God wasn't going to introduce me to this stuff. I had to go looking for it. I was asking people about it. I had done research about it. You know, thought, well, this won't hurt me, so I bumped into these guys at the University of Miami Student Union, and I said, tell me something. Do you know where I could find some pot? And this guy was a New Yorker. He was bowled away by my directness, so he figured he better talk to his brother about it. And sure enough, they decided they could trust me. They took me to a dorm room, and we smoked some pot, and I got high off the first hit. I was ready. And they played some music for me, and I said, oh, wow. And I drove home thinking I was doing 90 miles an hour, and I looked at the speedometer, and it was 25. But I soon got used to all that. And the next day, I was buying my own stash. Yeah, so, talk about progress. The disease could progress instantly. I went to town right away. I knew I was home. And my career of using lasted 15 years. I don't care how long your career has to last. It could be 5 years, 15, 25. The feelings are the same at the bottom. It doesn't matter if you hit your bottom in the suburbs or in the gutter. It makes no difference. What matters is how we feel. What matters is the emotional pain that we suffer knowing that our lives have gone to hell. That we find ourselves knowing that it should have been different. You know, I had such promise. What led me to this point? Because at my bottom, I had been smoking bass for a year. And I had been fired from my job, and I was being kicked out of my apartment, and I had my phone turned off and my lights turned off, and none of my friends would call. And, you know, went at the end of the road. That was the end of my road. It was March 21st of 1985 that I went into treatment. That was my first day clean. My last day using was March the 20th of 1985. And it's always struck me when I saw people pick up birthday medallions how a lot of people get squirrely around birthday time. And I figured it out. It's because the anniversary of my first day clean is also the anniversary of my last day using. You know, it's a commemoration of a bottom. In a way, it's a victory and a celebration, but it also commemorates a defeat, you know? It's sort of like these Civil War reenactors who parade up the hill with a Confederate flag. Well, they're commemorating a great defeat, and there's a lot of romance in a great defeat, but it's still a defeat, you know? And that was the take I put on it. And I kept hearing people say, you got to surrender, and I kept hearing defeat. And I heard people say, surrender to win, and I thought, bullshit. I didn't understand. What it means is to give up the struggle against the inevitable, to stop swimming uphill, to stop trying to fight what God has put into our lives. See, God will let us fight. I believe in it. Totally tolerant God who will let me keep struggling against the inevitable. But it's up to me at some point to surrender and say, okay, I've had enough. I'm willing to try something different. And that means even looking at things in different ways. For instance, what's good about being an addict? There are attributes in my character as an addict that have, in their addict form, they can be very destructive. But see, there's a difference between character and attitude. I don't have to change my character. I believe that my character is God-given. My character is my nature. There's nothing wrong with my nature. My problem is what I do with that and the attitude that I carry. I have to change my attitude. See, one of the good things about being an addict, or one of the tough things, the difficult things about being an addict, is that we have a built-in resistance to authority. You know, defiance. You're not going to tell me what to do, goddammit. But that can be turned into a good thing. It can enable independent thought and action. I'm glad that nobody told me I had to march lockstep and that I had to shave my head and sell basic texts at the airport. I'm grateful for that. We don't have a rigidity in NA. You know, we don't have rigid theology in NA. Thank God. You know, we're perfectly comfortable with hearing somebody say God and fuck in the same sentence and it doesn't faze us. You know, doesn't bother us a bit. You know, so we are capable of independent thought. We don't, you know, after all I've been through, it's kind of hard to offend me, you know. So why should I get up on a high horse? What's tough about being an addict is that we struggle with the need to people please. What becomes good about that is that it can mature into the desire to serve. See, we can begin to want what's good for other people. We can begin to care how other people feel. We can begin to become concerned, is my action for the highest good of all concerned? What's tough about being an addict is that we have the knowledge of deep suffering. I've been there. And what's good about that is that it can make us highly empathetic. Because I've suffered, I know when you've suffered. And I don't turn a blind eye. I'm not apt to be cold and unfeeling about the suffering of another person. I also get pissed off when I hear people say, well, pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. Give me a break. Some suffering is not optional. There's necessary suffering and there's unnecessary suffering. But you know what? If you see a kid in a hospital who's suffering, or an older person who's dying, or an animal who's broken a leg or something, that's suffering. And to walk up to them and say your suffering is optional, that'd be heartless. You know, what's optional is misery. See, because most of my misery is made by me. I make myself miserable. So the real saying, if you care to repeat it, is pain is inevitable, misery is optional. Well, we have great intensity of desire, and that got me into trouble my whole life, being led by my desires. But that can be turned positively towards recovery and spiritual growth. If you have a deep desire to recover and a deep desire to grow spiritually, that's a good thing. It isn't desire that's evil. It isn't even passion that's evil. See? It's good to be passionate. The problem is that we become obsessed with our passions. We were talking about that just last night, about the difference between obsession and passion. We have a one-track mind. You know, that can be a problem, but it can also be an asset. It can grow into one-pointed single-mindedness, and that can shut out distractions in meditation. You know, when we really want something, we can go for it. If we really want recovery, we can go for it. I've seen addicts become really whole hog, wholehearted students of recovery, and they want to go to every convention and get every souvenir and read every book. You know, that kind of one-pointedness can serve us. We have a checkered past. You know, that's one of our weaknesses. I mean, I can't run for office. They're going to dig up all kinds of shit on me. But there's a good side to that. It helps prevent smugness. There's no low life I'm going to look down on, you know? On the other hand, there's a wonderful saying I read somewhere that an addict is the only person in the universe who's capable of looking down on you while lying flat on his back in the gutter. Yeah. So, when we're in denial, we can be plenty smug. We have an eagerness for stimulation and peak experiences. You know, that's the need for a rush. And that can be turned towards God, and it can be turned towards love and noble efforts. We have a mind that has been warped by drug-induced delusions. And this might result in our becoming open to miracles. I saw some pretty weird shit when I was high. You know? And now, I'm open to many possibilities that I might not have otherwise been. There was a wonderful lady who's died maybe 12 years ago in our area. And she was great because she didn't lay trips on people. She was unconditionally loving. Her name was Gina. And Gina said, you know, we said, you know, what about the spiritual experiences that we've had when we use psychedelics and hallucinogens? You know, there's people in our groups who are saying, you should discount all that. It's all drug-induced. It's all crap. And she said, never discount any spiritual experience that you've had in your life. They're all precious. The challenge is now to have one clean. See? And if you work a program and get as close to God as you can have spiritual experiences every bit as profound, maybe even more so, than anything you had under the influence. The challenge is to get one and to share one clean, because that's even more important. The stuff that I did on drugs, I came down from. I couldn't even describe them to you. See? But the spiritual experiences that I've had clean, I can describe to you, because I was still there, see? My rational faculties, my ability to discriminate, my ability to think for myself comes with me when I have a spiritual experience clean. One of the things that I hear people berate is their own sense of wisdom. You know, I hear addicts call themselves all kinds of fool. But we ask for wisdom every day. We don't notice that we're doing it because we say it in the Serenity Prayer. We say, God, please grant me serenity, courage, and wisdom. Well, if you've been clean a few years and you've asked for wisdom every day, you've got some. Because God's very generous. The problem is engaging that wisdom, putting it to use. You know, when an addict says, I don't know nothing, well, in that case, you haven't been paying attention. You know something. Our problem is not that we know nothing. Our problem is not putting it into use, not engaging the information that we have and the wisdom that is ours. You know, and I think this comes from completing the program and working the steps to the best of our ability. Without the 10th, 11th, and 12th steps active in our lives, we have an incomplete program. And a lot of people chicken out early. I don't know if you've noticed. A lot of people don't want everything that this program has to offer, and that's fine. Just don't pretend that you want everything this program has to offer. Because one of the things this program has to offer is the knowledge of God's will and the power to carry that out. That's some heavy-duty stuff. I mean, knowing what God wants for me and learning to want the same thing for myself and gaining the power to make it real in my life, that's borderline miraculous in anybody's book. And I've seen that and seen it and seen it in the lives of addicts. It's wonderful what we can become and what we can do. As a result of this program, we can gain a sense of the miraculous. We see miracles happening in our lives and in the lives of others. We feel a closeness to wonder and miraculousness in our lives. I've heard people say that coincidence is God's way of acting anonymously. And that's kind of cute, but I would add something of my own to that, and that's that miracles are God's way of breaking his anonymity. See, when miracles happen, that's kind of God saying, guess who? It's me. I think it's important for us to permit ourselves to be spiritual and successful. You know, a lot of times the habits of a lifetime die hard, and a lot of times we have a hard time allowing ourselves to be spiritualized beings and to have successful lives. It's like we hold on to an attitude that we're permanently damaged somehow. But it's not the truth. The truth is that we're highly intelligent people who are here for being crazy. I'm not here for being stupid, I'm here for being nuts. You know, I think that's true of most of us. And we're very resourceful people. You know, one of the mistakes I hear is, well, you just don't have enough willpower. Willpower has nothing to do with it. You ask an addict who, a using addict who finds himself in a strange town, 2 a.m. on a Saturday night, no money and no dope, and he's still able to score, if he has any willpower, sure he's got willpower. He just doesn't have any won't power. We have a hard time saying no to ourselves. We have a hard time refusing our impulses. We have to use our experience. Part of my experience is using and the dangers that allowing my own impulses can take me. And part of my experience is recovering. When I had 12 years clean, I was shocked to realize that I had been recovering for a quarter of my life. You know, and that sort of amazed me. Next year, God willing, if I can stay clean, I'll have 15 years clean, which will be as long as I used. And when I was new, I said to myself, well, I'm going to consider myself a newcomer till I've been clean as long as I used. And then I'll see what happens. Guess what? I don't think anything's going to change. I think I'm going to keep coming back. Because you know what? It's still working. One of the things that we hear about is amends. And the amends process can be very healing. But some people think that they owe amends to God. And I think that's kind of grandiose. I don't think that I owe amends to God beyond self-realization. The only amends I believe we owe to God is our self-realization. And what is God's will for me? It's to truly realize who and what I am. See? So realize means to make real. It's not just to know or understand. It means to make something real. It's to turn it from something that's theoretical to something that's actual. There's even a joke about that. But the son who says to his father, Dad, what's the difference between theoretical and actual? And the father says, ask your mother if she would sleep with Robert Redford for $1 million. So the son goes and comes back and says, Mom says yes, she would. He says, now ask your sister if she would sleep with Robert Redford for $1 million. So he goes and comes back and says, yeah, Dad, Sis says she would sleep with Robert Redford for $1 million. He says, well, theoretically, we're sitting on a couple of $1 million. Actually, we're living with a couple of sluts. So it's important for us to get past the theory of recovery and make it real, make it part of our lives. Make this recovery an organic process rather than just be something that we talk about in meetings. In other words, I got to bring it home with me. See? A lot of us suffer emotional pain, and we don't realize that we can plug this program into our emotional pain. We can resolve it. But the problem is that we have an old model, and that's drugs. See, the solution to emotional pain is not chemical, it's spiritual. And, you know, if you don't remember anything else I said tonight, I hope you remember that one. Because there is a solution to emotional pain. But it comes from becoming still and knowing the presence of God within. And it comes from being happy. We have an option. I think it was President Lincoln who said that people are just about as happy as they have a mind to be. You know, I think that's wonderful. It suggests that We do have an option to be happier people if we want to be. A lot of our misery has to do with the woe is me stuff, you know, the poor me. That's my rationalization for everything that doesn't work in my life. You know, I wanted to do it, but those bastards, they talked me out of it. You know, every addict knows, I think it's Jackie Mason who talks about, everybody knows a building he could have bought 10 years ago for $9. You know, we're all so damn smart. But those bastards, they talked me out of it. Well, what about now? Now it's too late. Now. Sure. So rather than justify what hasn't worked in my life, it's important for me to find what does work. And there's a difference, by the way, between rationalization and justification. Rationalization is where you make something irrational rational. That's like you take something crazy and you give it a good explanation. Justification is where you take something unjust and you make it just. See, you do something wrong and you invent a good excuse. Well, they forced me into it. You know, they did it to me first, so I had no choice but to do it back. In my opinion, this is just my opinion, nobody else's bad behavior is a justification for my bad behavior. And, you know, it's important for me not to be drawn to somebody else's level just because I'm pissed off. And happiness is spirituality in action. Intelligence and beauty and even spiritual literacy can't compare to joy, because joy is infectious. A happy person can help other people be happy. I think that misery and meanness are their own punishment. You know, if somebody wants to be miserable and mean, you know, there's no punishment I can dream up worse for them that they have to be that way. If somebody wants to be a mean, miserable son of a bitch, I can't dream up any worse punishment than that. You know, let them. So, can't top that. There's gifts to sponsorship. Over time, as much as I've gained and grown from the people who have sponsored me, I've gained and grown equally from the men I've sponsored. One of the great gifts is the power of evocation. And that means that you draw people out. When I sit down with a sponsee and they ask me questions, I find that I'm drawn out spiritually, and I find that I know things that I didn't know I knew. You know? It's as though they awaken in me a knowledge and an understanding that may not have been clear to me. And one of the great gifts of that is that when you share it with somebody else, it's yours forever. That's what's meant by we can't keep what we have unless we give it away. Because when we give it away, we've formed it into a logical enough sequence of thoughts that we made somebody else understand it. And if you've understood it, then I've understood it. And it's mine forever. The importance of leadership. Now, I didn't know that I was a leader until I became a sponsor. It's helped me gain a sense of, you know, a leader doesn't say, go out there, man. A leader says, follow me. And so it forces me to be brave or to act spiritually or to do the right thing on a consistent basis, because I know I got sponsees watching. You know, and I don't do it just for that. I do it really for other reasons, but it helps. If I want my sponsees to make a certain number of meetings a week, I better be going too. You know, that's the importance of leadership. A gift of sponsorship is the use of wit and sensitivity and inspiration and practical sensibility. There's gifts of this program. There's gifts of a spiritual program of recovery. And if a sponsee asked me, what would this program do for me? You know, if I had to sell the program of recovery, what will this program do for me? I would tell them, your mileage may vary, but this is what it does for me. It can make me aware of how my addiction works, so that I can begin to break the cycle of sick response. I don't have to keep acting out in a sick way. It can relieve me of obsessions and compulsions. Obsession is where you can't stop thinking about something, and a compulsion is where you can't stop yourself from doing something. It's like putting your hand in the fire repeatedly, you know. This program breaks that cycle, fully and properly worked. It can provide a way out of hell. You know, Greg used to say, if you want to find NA, go to hell and make a left. And this is the way I found out of hell. It may not be heaven, but you know, it's like some people have this version of the 12 steps as a spiral staircase leading up to the stars, and I don't think of it that way. I think of it as a set of steps leading from the basement to the ground floor. You know, at least now I'm on an even level. I'm on an even keel with the rest of humanity. I'm not buried underground anymore. This program of recovery can relieve my suffering while it opens my heart to the suffering of others. It can change my perspective from materialistic and selfish to idealistic and generous. And it can change my relationship with God and with others and with myself. And the most important way that it's changed my relationship with myself is that I don't have low expectations of myself anymore. I don't expect the worst of myself anymore. I don't expect myself to fail anymore. I expect I'll at least hold my own and do pretty well, thank you. You know, this year I tried out for the third time for Jeopardy, and I passed the test again. I have a mind that's a maze of useless information, and I'm good at collecting all that stuff, and, you know, on the average night when I watch Jeopardy, I would win if I were playing. So the problem is that they can only use 250 people a year, and 25,000 people a year take the test. See, so I still only have like about 2,500 people pass the test, so I only have like a 1 in 10 shot of ever being called. But, you know, I can dream, can't I? The point is that I'm willing to try because I think I could win. And it's the same thing in recovery. I'm willing to try because I think I can win. See? One thing that this program can do is that it can give me a sense of hope and positive expectations. And it can provide a sense of sureness and stability and balance. It can also grant me equanimity and contentment and calm. And all equanimity means that it's okay with me either way. See, a lot of what has made my life unsettled is preferences. You know, I'm okay in company or all by myself. I'm okay going out for dinner or eating at home. I'm okay going to the 7:30 meeting or the 8:30 meeting. It's okay for me either way. See, if I have equanimity, it means that it's very hard to disappoint me. See, there can be pleasure and joy in my life, and I don't have to be disappointed just because things aren't going my way, because almost anything is my way. It's fine. This program can elevate my goals and aims, and it can elevate my viewpoint and my self-concept. I don't think of myself the same way I used to. It can also give me a miraculous reality rather than an ordinary or a crass one. I expect miracles in my life. I don't think of it just being about making money and saving money and retiring and then the slow decline to death. That's not what my life is about. It's about wonders and miracles. It's about the joy of sharing, you know. And the people I've seen grow old in recovery, that's what their life is about. It's about joys and wonders. One of the things I was asked when I was asked to come share here was to speak on the steps. And I don't really think I have time, and I wouldn't presume to speak on all the steps. All I know is that when people share on the steps, they usually have a lot to say on the first six or seven, and then they realize they're running out of time, and they always give short shrift at 10, 11, and 12. So tonight I'd like to share about 10, 11, and 12. Because every step is important. Every one of our steps is an exercise in miracles. And they're all links in a chain. See? They're equally important, equally valuable, equally significant for the strength of a program of recovery. One weak link doesn't matter. It's like a lot of times people will put a lot of emphasis on the fourth step and not really consider the fifth. Or put a lot of emphasis on the first and the third steps and not really see the significance of the second and how powerful it is. Well, I feel the same way about step 10. Step 10 comes after the amends, where people are usually going, phew. You know, and so they think of step 10 as an after statement or an afterthought, and it's not. It's powerful. You know, it's about, we continue to take a personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. And that says so little, and it says so much. First, there's a difference between a personal inventory and a moral inventory. And a lot of people just think of this as a restatement of their moral inventory. And it's not. If I'm still being immoral and harming people, I need to go back and work a fourth step. And I need to go back and work an eighth and ninth step and make amends. Personal inventory, a moral inventory is an inventory of my morals. Personal inventory is an inventory of my person. My personal choices, my personal attitudes, my personal behavior. My personal likes and dislikes, if you will. My person, my personal life. And a lot of that has nothing to do with morality. A lot of that has only to do with the personal choices that will make me happy or make me miserable. And when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. It doesn't say moral wrongs, and it doesn't say when we hurt people. You know, my first 4 or 5 years, I kept hearing people talk about the 10th step as though they were apologizing for hurting people's feelings. That's the least of it. That's the very least of it. The virtue of this step is that I'm able to transcend the need to always be right. See, I had a dad who was always right. My father, God bless him, was never wrong. There was no point in arguing with him because he was never wrong. And it took years, you know, right through my teens, this frustrated the hell out of me. It tied me in knots. And it was not until my late 20s that I realized that what my father was struggling was with a deep insecurity. The reason why he could never be wrong was because he felt profoundly insecure. And the only thing that made him feel secure was to always be right. Well, one of the gifts of this program is that I don't need to be right to be secure. I have the love and support of other addicts and of a higher power who cares about me. Also, by the time I'm at the 10th step, I've gained a lot of self-approval. The main reason to never be wrong is that you feel terrible about yourself. And by having a life where most of the time I'm doing the right thing and feeling pretty good about myself, if I'm occasionally wrong, it's no skin off my nose. It's not the worst thing that's going to happen in my day to be wrong today. I can say, yeah, you know what? I was wrong. And it doesn't throw me into a depression. It doesn't make me a worthless piece of shit. You know, because I did 428 right things today. See? And it isn't admitting it to anyone else. It's admitting it to me that's important. And the gift of this is by transcending the need to always be right, I can identify when I'm wrong. I don't have to live in pretense. I don't have to put up this brave front of being Mr. Perfect anymore. And since I'm not pretending to be perfect, I can become more perfect. I can identify those areas in my personal life that are incorrect, imperfect, causing me trouble, giving me pain, and alter course, promptly admit it, and take action to change it. One of the gifts of this step is self-monitoring. And by this I mean that instead of waiting to the end of the day to make an inventory of my day and say, well, I did this wrong, I'm talking about doing this all the time so that as I'm about to take an action, I can observe it, I can hold it up in front of me and say, is this the best for all concerned? Am I doing the right thing? Is my motivation ego or is it God? And when that's what I'm doing, the miracle of promptly is that I can stop myself, I can restrain myself before saying or doing the wrong thing even leaves my lips. See, spiritualizing our lives means that the gift of this step is that we can actually have auto-correction in our lives. We can stop ourselves before we blow it. That's the gift of this step. promptly becomes the ability to stop ourselves before we act out, before we make a fool of ourselves, before we do something that we'll be ashamed of. So I think this is a very powerful step. Step 11 is about seekers and finders. You know, finders, keepers, losers, weepers. One of the things that I've, you know, it says we sought through prayer and meditation. A seeker is not necessarily a finder. One of the things that we have to do when we seek through prayer and meditation knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry it out is when we find it, to put it into use rather than to keep seeking. You know, I know people who do the whole esoteric circuit, and they'll go chant with this group and meditate with this group, and then they'll go and do yoga with this group, and then they'll come over here and do prayer worships with this group, and you know, they call it the esoteric circuit. And it's kind of a good idea to settle down one place and make some place home, just like I made a home in NA. I think it's important for us not to make seeking a career, but to actually, once we found something, to develop it, nurture it, culture it, help it build into something that fills our lives. I think there's a distinction in this step between unconscious and conscious contact. I think that unconscious contact is what keeps me alive. I believe I've always been in unconscious contact with my higher power. That's like that golden thread between my soul and God. And that keeps me alive. That's reaches right to the spirit at the center of my nature and the center of my being. And that's my unconscious contact. Conscious contact is being aware of it, being alert to the fact that God is in my life all the time. No days off, no exceptions. See? How would we behave if we knew that God was looking over our shoulder all the time? And I don't think of it that way because I don't have a judging God. God is not judging or condemning me. God is always there. You know, God's there when I snore at a meeting. God is there if I masturbate. God is there if I eat too much. God is there if I share lovingly with a friend. In other words, I don't have to be ashamed in the presence of God, but I do have to be aware of God's presence. I certainly can't pretend that it disappears somehow. How would we behave and how would we think and how would we act if we were always aware all the time that God was present? First, it might shame us, but gradually it'll change and it'll give us power. See? Now, this is a conundrum. This is one of those strange paradoxes in Narcotics Anonymous, is that in the first step we talk about power, we talk about becoming powerless. We admitted that we were powerless over our addiction, that our lives have become unmanageable. And a lot of addicts become in love with powerlessness as though that were a good thing. Now, it's not about becoming powerless. I already was powerless. It's about admitting our powerlessness and not putting on this tough, brave front. I'm this powerful guy. You know, I can quit anytime I want, you know. I think it was Mark Twain who said, quitting smoking is easy. I've done it 1,000 times. You know. But the power that I give up willingly in the first step, I gain back in the 11th step, but on God's terms. See, I don't believe that we become powerful of our own will or of our own cleverness. I believe we can become powerful beings because we begin to gain God's power. You know, we seek the help of a higher power. We become empowered by a higher power. We let that power energize and fill our lives with light and with life. I think that this step also tells us that we're never so holy that there isn't room for improvement. You know, one of the conversations we were having today was about saints, and I've mentioned this before. I believe that we have saints in Narcotics Anonymous, that all of us who are aspiring towards a spiritual life and who act miraculously in the lives of others, that in a different time and place they would call that being a saint. But we don't call it that anymore because it's an anonymous program. See? And we'd almost be embarrassed to be called saints. But really, leading a beautiful, loving life and working miracles in the lives of others, that's very saintly. There's a word in this step called only. That's the narrowing word of this step. Praying only for knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry it out. Well, that's what they talk about the road narrows, you know. Or you could say that it's like a shipping channel. The channel narrows, but we can carry more draft because it also deepens. Only for knowledge of his will and power. Well, hell, if I ask only for knowledge and power, I'm asking for the whole ball of wax. You know, God's going to leave it up to me to earn the new car. You know, God's going to leave it up to me to find meaningful relationships. What I need from God is not, you know, a relationship and a car and a job. What I need from God is knowledge and power. So this step instructs us to start asking for the right thing. Not, God, help me not be nervous when I walk into a meeting. But, God, help me know what your will is for me and give me the power to carry it out. When I know what God wants and when I have the power to carry it out, I'm not going to be nervous walking into a meeting. See? Knowledge and power. Very powerful. Step 12 is the only step with an implicit guarantee that we have had an awakening of the Spirit. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to addicts and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Well, this says to me that the prior 11 steps have awakened the Spirit, and one of the things I've heard and I believe is that there's a spiritual awakening in every step. But I believe that the whole process is a process of awakening the Spirit, like the unfolding of a flower. Sort of like a flower opening in the sun. I think there's something in the basic text that says the same thing. It's sort of like we're able to greet the soul of another person because we're awakened spiritually. I do not pretend that the people I meet today are just things. They are also beloved children of God. They're also souls. They're also spirits. If my spirit is awake, it's very hard for me to objectify or make an object of another person. In fact, it's even hard for me to do that to an animal. I believe that animals have rights too. And I believe that they need to be treated with respect and with love and with consideration and kindness as well. So we've had an awakening of the Spirit. Well, what is an awakened spirit? That's one that is always alert and always aware and always present. And 12-step says having had a spiritual awakening. Well, this doesn't just mean that you've discovered that you're a really nice guy or that you've learned to behave like ladies and gentlemen or that you practice religious rituals. It means that the Spirit is wide awake all the time, that it can't be bribed or tricked into going unconscious again. It means that the ego is no longer in control of your decisions. The Spirit is. See, I don't believe in the annihilation of the ego as a result of this program. If I had no ego, I could not be up here talking to you. It's just that the ego is transparent. It means you can see right through it, hopefully, to the soul underneath it. When we're sharing with each other soul to soul, the ego is present, but it's not the main subject. Spirit is the main subject. It means that the spiritual awakening means that we're so alert that the disease cannot sneak up on you unawares anymore. Because if I have a knowledge of God's will for me and I'm taking my personal inventory on a regular basis or on a consistent basis, it's not like the disease is going to pile up on me. I'm going to catch it way before it gets out of hand. You know, It's not like I'm going to become so asleep that I'll find myself in a weekend in Vegas blowing $1,000 not knowing what's happened. It won't happen because I won't get that far. It'll stop when I cussed out somebody crossly, and I'll say, you know, that was wrong, and I'll apologize to them. And I won't even get those many steps down the road of negativity and self-indulgence and cruelty and thoughtlessness that'll lead me to acting out in some kind of a wacky and self-destructive way. And it means that you always know that in the back of your head that God is present, like I was saying before. And it means that your life is never going to be the same. If you have an active 12th step, it means it's very hard to go back. Not impossible, mind you. We can always go back to sleep. Just like we can have a spiritual awakening, we can also have a spiritual sleepening. You know, if I don't want what this program has, I've seen it happen. I've seen people who had vibrant programs that I admired back away from recovery, become disappointed in the program and in themselves, and start feeding some kind of compulsion. Could be gambling, could be eating, could be work. You know, workaholism is a classic compulsion, and the wonderful thing about it is that the society rewards it. You know? I mean, isn't that nice? 12th step says that we tried to carry this message to addicts. Well, what message? That you can stay abstinent from drugs? Well, how many times do we have to hear that mere abstinence without a life based on principles is an exercise in futility? It avails us nothing just to be clean without doing something about it. When you take the drugs out of a drug addict, you're still left with an addict. One of the best sayings I've heard is that the most miserable person in the world is an addict with no recovery and no dope. The message that we carry is the steps. That is the message of recovery. And the message that we can recover by working these steps, and that through these 12 steps, an addictive mentality can be dramatically reshaped into a God-centered soul. The statement, we tried to carry this message, is embedded in the steps, and it's part of them, so it can only refer to them. So the point is that your recovery in the steps, since we carry this message, your recovery in the steps is not complete until you have begun teaching these steps to other addicts. That is ultimately the way we carry this message. So if you're sponsoring addicts but you're not teaching them the steps, you're not working your 12th step. Simple as that. It was hard for me when I was a new sponsor with only 4 steps under my belt to really carry the message of recovery. It's much easier now because I believe that the steps aren't just about do this written assignment. It's about living a different life. It's about engaging God and humans in a different way. You know, we practice these principles in all our affairs, says the 12th step. Well, if you've still reserved some part of your life to being addictive or acting out or being unprincipled, then you also can't work the 12th step because this says all our affairs, not most of them or the convenient ones. Whenever an addict excuses cruelty or inhumanity in his behavior or justifies an injustice or rationalizes the irrational and looks for reasons why the principles of recovery need not extend that far, he's opting out of the full flower of recovery through the 12th step. If I'm wide awake spiritually, and if I'm carrying a message and practicing principles, then I'm obligated to be self-aware and available to others and morally responsible. This is the completion of a balanced program. It's not enough just not to get loaded anymore and pay your bills. I do have a couple of radical comments, and then I'll close. One radical comment is that you don't have to work the steps, provided that you have a program of equal or superior effectiveness to work instead of the steps. If you got something better, Solid. Terrific. God bless you. You're going to have to prove it to me, but you're welcome to try. On the other hand, you don't have to reinvent the wheel either. You don't have to get a relationship with a higher power, provided that you've developed your own way of restoring yourself to sanity, or removing your own defects of character, or acquiring spiritual principles through logic and obtaining serenity, courage, and wisdom out of your own intelligence. Be a good trick, right? You don't have to carry a message. You don't have to serve the fellowship. You don't have to practice principles or awaken your spirit, provided that you're satisfied with a merely selfish program, an empty shell, a tiny fraction of what your recovery could be. You don't have to do what any of the recovering addicts before you have done, provided that you are clever enough to devise your own program and teach yourself a subject that you don't know. I'm not that smart, and I'm pretty smart. You don't have to follow suggestions. You can just run your own will, provided that you're ready to assume responsibility for all the consequences. I hate it when that happens. You don't have to recover. You can just stay clean, provided that you don't mind enduring a lifetime of suffering with neither recovery nor dope. This program works if you work it, and it doesn't, and it can't work if you don't work it. If you don't want it, you don't have to have it. But if you want it, you don't have to reinvent it all for yourself. You can start by copying what has worked for the rest of us. And as you progress, you'll flesh it out, and your program will become more tailored to you. And in time, your program will be robust and individual, and it'll be informed by your own character, and you will make it your own. It's just like I've said to a sponsee, if you don't have a higher power, you can borrow mine for a while, but you have to give it back and get one of your own. Same thing with recovery. You can borrow my program for a while, but eventually you're going to have one of your own. There's no transfusion of recovery. See? Well, I always try to have a closing prayer. And I always think up sometime, someday, it happened two nights ago as I was packing. I was running late again, as usual. This is what came to me. Dear God, please light my path and guide my steps and ease my fear, my worries, and my confusion. Please help me know the difference between real dangers in my way and the lurid imaginings that are born of loneliness and exhaustion. Grant me the foresight and practical caution to prepare myself and to protect myself so that my baser instincts are not able to draw me into danger and harm. Please help me to be strong and courageous and wise and careful so that even real dangers do not have the power to trick or trap me. Please let me find peace where there is conflict and truth where there is darkness and joy where there is sorrow and a little humor where there is too much seriousness. Help me be the calm eye in the center of the storm, aware of the turbulence of daily life, but never drawn into its destructive blast. Allow me to be a calming and healing influence when others need a steady hand, a steady head and a reassuring hand. And let me always know, too, that you are always there to calm and reassure me and help my faith transcend my fear. There's a lot of ways we can confuse ourselves. Some thoughts woke me up at 5 a.m. a few weeks ago. One of them was that this is a multiple-choice universe, but lots of people keep getting stuck answering true-false. And if so, they get at least 75% of their answers wrong. It's better to let God lay the whole thing out for us rather than choose when offered just the first two choices. In other words, be patient. There's more to be explained. Also, God has no deadlines. It's never too late for God. God loves us no matter what we choose. We can eat ourselves up with pettiness, or we can follow God's example and love and forgive. God forgives me for everything. It's I who hold shit against myself. And God says, I love you, and I want to argue with him and say, no, you don't understand. I'm this miserable addict. So who am I to argue with God? God created me and said I was good. Who am I to argue with God? Or as one clever soul said, God don't make junk. See, one of the reasons why we do an amends process is to let somebody else forgive us. People think it's all about me, but it's not just about me. It's also about them. They've carried a stone in their heart for many years. I don't know whether all the people I've made amends to have forgiven me. All I know is that I need to try to forgive what was done to me. A lot of stuff was done to me in my life. But I need to try to forgive it, not for the sake of those who did it, but for my own sake, so I can stop carrying a stone around in my heart. The gift of this program is so wide and so broad. But most of all, it's that we can have a beautiful life and that we don't have to stay stuck in the past. That's why if you forgive me for doing this different than normal, I could tell you stories. But thank God just for today, I have more to tell than just stories. And thank you very much for letting me share. Yeah.